Hello and welcome to Was Bitcoin Bringt, the Bitcoin podcast from Vienna, Austria, presented by Coinfinity. My name is Nico Jilch, and today I have the pleasure to talk to Seyfeddin Amuz, the economist and author of the Bitcoin Standard, and now the Fiat Standard. The Fiat Standard was just published in German by our good friends at Apricot Media, who take all the best texts and books about Bitcoin and translate them to German to publish them in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. Seyfeddin Amuz, he was here in Vienna in 2018 to give the very, very first presentation about his international bestseller, The Bitcoin Standard. And I was the moderator back then. It was a pleasure back then. It's a pleasure now. So we're going down memory lane here a bit. We also talk about the past, the present, and the future of the monetary system. And Seyf, he does have a very hopeful message, actually, for the monetary system, even for the future of fiat in combination with Bitcoin that can solve so many problems. A short word from our sponsors, and then we'll get straight into the interview. Apricot Media is the first, only, and best publisher of German language books on Bitcoin. Their bestseller is The Bitcoin Standard by Seyfeddin Amuz, and they just published Layered Money by Nick Bhatia. On their website, apricot.media, you can order books and pay using the Lightning Network. Coinfinity is Austria's first Bitcoin broker and your partner for the long-term Bitcoin strategy. They have excellent support and fair prices, and a focus on customer satisfaction. Coinfinity is a firm run by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. You can find their physical store in the city of Graz and reach their website from everywhere, coinfinity.co. Incrementum is an independent asset manager, a fund manager, and a research firm based in Liechtenstein. The Incrementum partners Ronald Stöffele and Mark Wallet are experts on the topic of sound money and the Austrian School of Economics. They published a legendary Ingobi Trust Report, where I am also an author. Find them at incrementum.li. I'm now talking to Seyfeddin Amuz, the author of The Bitcoin Standard, The Fiat Standard, which I've got right here. It was just published in German at Apricot Media. Hello, Seyf. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me, Nico.
Thank you so much for having the time. I just spent two days listening to you and Lex Friedman and a four-hour podcast. So it is an honor that you would take the time for my humble podcast and the German-speaking audience. We will have German subtitles, of course. And we're trying to explore the way Bitcoin, we think, you think, is going to change the way we live and the world we live in. First off, do you believe that Bitcoin is something that's going to stay and that's basically dominating the field of money in 10, 15 years?
Yes. The short answer to this is, I don't see Bitcoin going away. You have to always remain open-minded to all kinds of possibilities. But realistically, there comes a point, of course, anything can go away, but there comes a point, you know, when you're talking about things where it starts to make sense to think of the default scenario as those things being around rather than those things disappearing. So the internet is a great example. It doesn't make sense to live your life planning on the internet dying tomorrow or next week, because it makes a lot more sense to plan on it being there tomorrow and next week and investing and living accordingly. So my general view has not really changed on this since writing the Bitcoin Standard. I think it's, the fundamentals are still there. Bitcoin is still decentralized. Bitcoin is still not under anybody's control. Nobody can change the supply. Nobody can change anything about how it works. And the supply is fixed. It's running exactly according to schedule. Not exactly, but, exactly close enough to what is intended. It was never meant to be an exact schedule. So, I think Bitcoin's monetary role is just going to grow. I think it's just, I encourage people to think about this as just stop being so emotional about it, because it involves their national currency, which they have been taught to love and cherish, and just think about it like a market good. It's just a much better way of doing money than national currencies, and it's just going to continue to grow as part of people's cash balances and in terms of value, both because it appreciates in real terms, but also because everything else is depreciating in real terms. So they're just making more and more money. And even though making more money, they think they're creating more wealth and creating more value, all that it is actually doing is destroying the wealth and value that is stored in your money. So all of Bitcoin's competitors are essentially committing suicide in terms of money by inflation. And the last couple of years have massively intensified that. So they're increasing their supply, they're decreasing the value that is stored in them, whereas Bitcoin continues to increase a supply only according to the schedule, which is declining in its growth rate. And it continues to just become more and more valuable, and its value increases. So I don't see what would reverse these two strong fundamental trends. I think the counter argument would be very hard to make. The idea that national currencies are going to get better at storing value while Bitcoin is going to somehow become compromised and prevented from storing value, I think is far less compelling than the opposite, which is that the next 10, 15 years are going to be like the last 10 years.
So we met in 2018, that's 5 years ago, in Vienna, and it was your wish to start your book tour in Vienna because you're an Austrian economist who doesn't spring from Austria. And it was a very, very memorable evening. I was the moderator of the event. What I remember is two things. I remember my eyes burning because of a medicine that I got from my eye doctor on that day, and I couldn't really open my eyes. And the second thing I remember is that this guy is nuts. That's what I thought. That's what I thought, you know? Because also because of my like emotions, this was like in the 2018 bear market, right? And now we're in the 2022 bear market. So emotions always play a big role. And also because I'm a big gold bug. I think you started out as a gold bug. I think you said that in the last podcast. So maybe, you know, for recovering gold bugs, why is Bitcoin better than gold, and how do we get there, you know, emotionally?
Yeah. So, yeah, I remember that event. Incidentally, it was the first talk on my book tour, so after publication of the Bitcoin Standard. And I wanted to have it in Austria. And I just went on Google and I looked up Bitcoin Vienna and found Harold Schilly. I hope he's listening. Hello, Harold.
He's listening.
He is listening, yeah.
Yes.
So I just emailed him and said, hey, I wrote this book about Bitcoin and it's all about Austrian economists and Bitcoin. I'd like to do a talk in Vienna. Will you guys host me? And he responded maybe the same day or the next day. He's like, yeah, this looks great. Let's do it. And then a few weeks later, everything was arranged. They got an amazing palace in downtown Vienna, which was just an incredible venue. I don't think anything matches that. It'll be very hard to beat that kind of venue. It's an old, I think it's called Esterhazy Palace was the name of the building. It's an old building in downtown Vienna where we had the event, remember it? It belonged to National Bank, I think. Is that what they're called?
The sponsors? It wasn't the National Bank. It was a Kapitalbank. It's a private bank.
Kapitalbank, yes.
Yes. And it's an old palais, you know, with all like gold. Especially, there was no Bitcoin on the walls. There was gold on the walls, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a very good turnout for a bear market event. And you were not famous back then. I think I can say that. But it worked really well because people were interested. And I talked to Johannes Grill, who also was one of the organizers from Bitcoin Austria, just from my last episode. And he said, you know, bear markets are for building things and for taking the time to do new stuff. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but what you did is you wrote a book about Bitcoin. You wanted to explain Bitcoin to the world. And now you wrote a book about fiat to basically explain the world to Bitcoiners and other people as well. But Bitcoiners are going to read this book first, right?
Yeah. And I think eventually, you know, everybody's going to be a Bitcoiner. So eventually this is going to be a much better way of approaching fiat. It's going to be the default way. Eventually, everybody's going to be on Bitcoin and off fiat. And then if they want to understand fiat, they're going to need to understand it through Bitcoin's framework. So this is, I think, highly future compatible, the way of writing this book. So to go back to your question on gold, I think the reason of why Bitcoin is better than gold is that a lot of the fascination with gold is is tied to its physical properties and its shininess and its color and so on. And that just produces an attachment. It's just a material thing that produces an attachment in people's minds. And then they can't get over that part of it. But really, the reason that gold has its monetary role, which is different from its shiny yellow role, is not that it is shiny and yellow and pretty. The reason is that it has the economic properties of a low supply growth rate or a high stock to flow ratio. So this is really what it is. It's just that gold always has a low supply growth rate. And Bitcoin does that better. So that's the first way that Bitcoin is better, because Bitcoin's supply growth rate declines faster than the supply growth rate of gold. Currently, they're about the same growth rate. I should be accurate. Currently, they're around the same 1.8% per year. But over the next few years, Bitcoin's supply growth rate is just going to continue to decline, whereas gold's growth rate is likely going to stay the same, if not potentially increase. Also within that, I think the second major problem with gold, of why Bitcoin is better than gold, is that Bitcoin is much faster and cheaper to move around. So if you wanted to move around $1 billion worth of gold between two banks in two different continents, you're talking about a logistical nightmare of an operation. I mean, you're going to be moving around $1 billion worth of value. That's a lot of gold. And to verify it at each stage to make sure that it doesn't get tampered with or replaced with fakes, the only way to really trust it is to melt it down and recast it again. The only way to can verify it. So it's pretty expensive to move and verify gold around. It's very cheap to do it with Bitcoin right now. And even if Bitcoin's movements, even if Bitcoin's price movement increases by 1,000-fold, transaction fees, if they increase the transaction fees in Bitcoin by 1,000-fold, it's still very competitive next to gold. You can still send very, very cheaply, relatively. You know, if you could send $1 billion of Bitcoin for $5,000 transaction fee, that's still a bargain compared to sending $1 billion of gold, which is going to cost a lot more than $5,000.
And that's how we should compare the Bitcoin to the technology, right? It's not Bitcoin compared to the Visa network. It's Bitcoin compared to moving gold bars around.
Yes, that's really the better comparison, because it is final settlement. It's money that is not somebody else's liability. It doesn't require you to stay friends with the US government in order for it to work. You know, you take receipt of your Bitcoin or your gold and it just works. It doesn't require anybody else to do things for you. So these really are the two main properties. Bitcoin is going to be harder, so it's going to become more saleable across time. It's going to lose less value over time, or likely appreciate in value more than gold over time. And Bitcoin is faster and cheaper to move around, so therefore it is more saleable across space. It's going to lose value less as you move it across space. So those two things are really why, objectively, I think gold became money over other kinds of economic goods. Mm-hmm. Because it relatively, you know, compared to all other metals, it has the lowest supply growth rate, and it is the most valuable and dense and therefore cheapest to move around, and it is the most chemically stable. So all of those things made it most saleable across time and across space. And it is the fact that it has the supply growth rate that is low is a result of its physical properties, but it's distinct from its physical properties. You know, the fact that gold isn't consumed means the stockpiles are always growing, and so therefore new supply is added only in tiny, small little increments on top of it. So therefore, that's the economic property that gives gold its monetary role. So Bitcoin improves on that, and Bitcoin improves on gold's ability to move around. And I think the other thing that I would add, since writing the Bitcoin standard, and I allude to in the fiat standard, is that the more you look at how the gold market clearing works, the more you realize just how unscalable really it is for a global digital economy with so many billions of people all over the world trading so much money and value across the world. It just doesn't really scale to run it on having to move actual physical gold that can be tampered with. And the verification is so expensive And the reality today is that the gold market is full of tungsten. I think this is something that you can, you can go on Alibaba.com and you can look for gold coins that are, they call them real fake gold coins. And it's, from the outside, it's all tungsten. Sorry, from the outside, it's all gold, but in the inside, it has some tungsten. So you manage to get it for something like a quarter of the price of the regular gold bar. And you could just order this from the equivalent of Amazon in China, and you can order it anywhere in the world. So think about how many of these coins and bars all over the world are full of tungsten, and then understand what that does to the dynamics of the market. I think this effectively takes away the monetary properties of gold because it turns it into an industrial metal. Because every year, we're not just adding 2% to the supply from gold mining, we're adding maybe, say, 5% because there's all of this tungsten that gets added in all over the world. So maybe that's another, maybe that's equivalent to mining supply. And then over the next year, two, three, four, five, some of that tungsten gets discovered and then it gets taken out of the gold coin and it melted out. And then you're taking that part out of the supply. So we're moving toward this market that's becoming more like an industrial metal because you're adding in supply, which is the fake tungsten, and then you're taking out the supply. So it's no longer this metal that is just constantly accumulating with a low supply growth rate. It's becoming this industrial metal where we're adding a lot of supply every year and then taking a lot of that supply out because some of it is tungsten. But also, and here's the other thing, many of the gold bugs mentioned, you know, well, we have industrial uses. The more industrial uses for gold, the less of a monetary metal it is. The more people use it, the more people take money, take gold out of the monetary use and then use it in industrial uses, effectively they're taking it out of the stockpile. So they're increasing the, they're decreasing the stockpile, lowering the stock to flow ratio and making gold more of an industrial metal, which is what we've seen happen with silver over the last 100 years. The value goes down, so more and more of it gets used in industry. So now the stock to flow for silver is closer to 3 rather than 20, which is what it supposedly was about 100 years ago. Because now you just use silver in all kinds of industrial things, and so you're constantly making new monetary metal, but you're constantly taking a lot out of that monetary metal, and it's being used for industry. So you're back to a store of value that can't really store value well, because as soon as the price spikes, there's just so much spare capacity in industry that can be dumped onto the market, and it destroys the monetary premium in the monetary silver. I think we're going to start seeing the same happen with gold. It's just technological progress.
But even without fake gold and even without the industrial uses, I mean, it's funny because people, we have fiat money has no industrial use, paper money has no industrial use, but with Bitcoin, that's suddenly a problem that it doesn't have a use as a commodity. Of course, it isn't, you know, it's used as money. But gold over the centuries, and that was one of your central points in the Bitcoin standard, is it was centralized. It was controlled by the central banks. Now it's in their vault, so they know what to do with it. They didn't completely get rid of it because for some reason they still hold a lot of gold, maybe just to control it. And then they replaced it with, you know, the fiat, right? So can we talk about what you write in your book? So what is fiat money and why was it able to replace gold in our economy? And is this something that happened only by force? Is it something that is it a technology that was just better? What happened there?
So, I start the fiat standard by looking at that question. You know, I started the Bitcoin standard by with Satoshi's email to the mailing list. And I initially, it was almost like a parody that I wanted to write the fiat standard almost exactly like the Bitcoin standard to draw the analogy between them as being two monetary systems. In other words, you know, I wrote the Bitcoin standard from just scratch. You know, so how do you explain Bitcoin to somebody who knows nothing about Bitcoin, but who can read? And you can just get them up to speed to understand what's going on here, why this thing is important and why it matters. And the same thing I wanted to do with fiat. So I decided, all right, let's just do the same thing. What's the equivalent of the fiat system to Bitcoin in every way? What is the fiat white paper? How did fiat start? Who's the Satoshi Nakamoto? How does this thing work? And so I think, you know, the Satoshi Nakamoto is the Bank of England, basically. And as an institution, they've just always been able to do a bit of inflation on the side and get away with it. And fiat was born in World War I. So I look at the really how Bank of England moved off the gold standard. And this is extremely fascinating stuff because it is extremely important, extremely significant. I mean, civilization-altering level of political importance and economic importance. And because it is basically about the central bank doing bad things, and the central banks control a lot in education and the media, it's not something that is mentioned or discussed often. And so in 2017, we had this new bunch of data that was released from the Bank of England. A bunch of new people in the Bank of England dug into the basement and found this study that was written in the 1920s by the chief of the bank at that time, who wanted a full study of what the Bank of England did in World War I. And that study was not published when it was made. It was just for the bank's own records. And it was only made available in 2017. And it's extremely, extremely important and extremely fascinating and, of course, extremely under-discussed. Nobody in the fiat world likes to talk about this stuff. So even after it was published in 2017, all the fiat academics are just completely silent on it and what it means. And we learned how the fiat story started. So the Bank of England, you know, they were already engaging in a little bit of inflation before the war because they were the central bank for the world. Everybody had to have an account with the Bank of England, more or less. And they were settling trade for most of the world's populations, and particularly the British colonies. So they, their bank was holding gold for other countries. And because those countries needed to use the Bank of England, they weren't going to liquidate that gold very often. So they would leave a lot of that gold. And the Bank of England had the freedom to go ahead and, you know, get creative with using that gold. So it had a relatively low cover of gold for its pound notes because its network was so valuable that everybody had to leave a lot of gold on there all the time. And that's how they ran their colonial system. You know, that's how they were... That's why they were so keen on the colonies, because the more people you put on the central banking system, the more you get to dump your bags on them. Just print more pounds and take their gold, and you can make a few more extra pounds with every bit of extra gold you make, because you control the rails, you know, you control the payment network. So World War I comes along, and the British government wants to go and fight in World War I because, you know, why not? And they realize, all right, well, we need funding for war. And what they used to do back in the days of the gold standard, this was still on the gold standard days, relatively. I mean, they weren't on 100% gold standard, but they were still on a gold standard. And they could still redeem pounds in gold, in their nominal face value at gold. But then they choose to go into World War I, the stupidest mistake in human history. And they decide to raise bonds. That's what people did under the gold standard. You raised bond if you wanted to go to war. And then people would buy your bonds. And if you win the war, you can pay the bonds back. And the British people just decided they had better shit to do with their life than buy those stupid war bonds. So they offered £400 million of bonds, I think, for the war was the issue. But only a third of these were subscribed. So people only bought a third of the bonds needed to fund the war effort, which was embarrassing because, you know, you can't just fight a third of a war. What are you going to do? Now, obviously, the intelligent thing would have been to just not fight a stupid war that Britain had no business entering in the first place. There was no reason for Britain to enter World War One, really. There was no reason for anybody to enter World War One, most likely. It's a stupid war that just derailed civilization. And the reason it derailed civilization, the reason it was not just another 19th century war where a bunch of armies fought in battlefields and then things ended, is because of fiat. Is because the Central Bank of England then decided, hey, you know what? We don't need to get people to buy our stupid bonds. We can just quantitatively ease and buy those bonds. And that's where this starts. So the Bank of England then goes and issues all these, issues credit to the to two people who work at the bank, two high-ranking officials at the bank. They issue credit to them and they buy the government bonds. They buy the government bonds for the they buy two-thirds of the government's bonds. So the British people bought one-third of the bonds issuance. And the Bank of England, through two individuals alone, bought two-thirds. And then the Bank of England went and told the fiat shitcoin influencers at the Financial Times to write the headline about how the bond issue was fully subscribed and that, you know, we're going to the war and we're going to win the war. And we managed to get all the money for the war from the British people buying the bonds. Well, the British people didn't buy the bonds. The Bank of England bought the bonds. And how did it buy it? By printing fiat, by making credit fiat money. And therefore, they bought it with inflation. And the cost was going to materialize over the coming years and decades. And it was going to result in all of the problems, in all the post-war economic problems in the UK and the US and all over the world. You know, the inflation and the bubble of the 1920s and the Great Depression, all of that was a consequence of going off the gold standard in 1914. That's when Britain went off the gold standard. The US followed in 1917. Everybody went off the gold standard at that time. Everybody went crazy. And here's the really, really, really nefarious and mendacious thing about it, which is that they went off the gold standard in 1914, 17 in the case of the US, and they continued to suffer from the consequences until they formally abandoned the gold standard in 1934 and blamed it on the gold standard. And that's really this is why nobody in fiat will talk about this, because it's one of those facts that is just extremely, extremely destructive to the entire worldview. Because the entire worldview of the Keynesian fiater is that, this is hilarious, but really this is what these people truly believe, that the gold standard was the problem. And up until the 1930s, the world was on a problematic monetary system that wasn't working. And then in the 1930s, thanks to a genius called Keynes, we figured out that we don't need gold as money. We can just print all the money that we need because the government can just magically print all that money. And therefore, we can have all of the nice stuff that we want because the government can just print. And so once we went off the gold standard in 1934, then the economy is fixed. And this is what people truly believe. Of course, the reality is they went off the gold standard in 1914. All of the problems that followed were a consequence of that and the inflation that came with the gold standard. And then the going off the gold standard in the 1930s was an even bigger problem. And that's what deepened and worsened the depression and led to World War II. And only after World War II and after basically the rebuilding of the Bretton Woods system on some kind of gold backing, did we get a couple of decades of stability before the inflation came back in again and the cancer began to metastasize.
And Keynes did learn his lesson in a way, because he went to Bretton Woods and he said, we need a neutral reserve currency, you know, like gold. But he didn't talk about gold. Obviously, he wanted to have his own thing. But he basically, you know, said that we need something like Bitcoin.
No, he didn't. No, he wasn't a Bitcoiner. He wanted something called Bancor and nothing Bitcoin. He wanted something that him and his degenerate idiot Cambridge friends could sit around and decide the fate of humanity with. It's completely idiotic, nonsensical, totalitarian idea. Basically, there would be this IMF thing, and the IMF would issue its own currency, and then the whole world would run on that currency, and the whole world would, all the governments would just take that currency, and then that IMF board, which is managed by Keynes and morons like Keynes, would decide how much everybody gets money everywhere in the world. It's insane. They would decide the monetary policy for the whole planet. The whole world would just have to take it from them.
But so that planet is still alive. That planet is still alive. They're still talking about that today.
I know, but it's nothing like Bitcoin. It's the exact opposite of Bitcoin. If he wanted Bitcoin, he would have wanted the gold standard at that time. He just wanted to be in charge. But of course, Americans got their way, and they got that thing to be the dollar, which is kind of the same thing. But at least it's, I think, in a sense, it's much more sane, at least when you have a credit-based monetary system like fiat, is much better than a truly Keynesian monetary system like the Bancor, which is like the CBDC, basically. So if you think fiat is bad, you know, wait until you try the CBDCs. If you think the banks are bad, wait until you get rid of the banks and you have one Goss bank. There's one central bank only in your entire country, and it's run by your country's most Keynesian.
Do you think we'll see CBDCs in Europe and in America?
I mean, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. And I think like last year or 2 years ago, it looked a little bit more likely with all of the insanity that was taking place with COVID and the way that people seem to be just discussing all of this techno-utopia as the solution to all of life's problems. Now I think there's quite a bit of backlash. And I think politically the idea is quite unpopular with people, but also I think perhaps more importantly, it's unpopular with financial sector. It's unpopular with banks. And, you know, banks aren't exactly powerless, helpless victims of democracy. So I think they'll probably manage to prevent it if it does come about from being, you know, a complete Goss bank digitally.
So you take 1914... mm-hmm. as like the birth date of fiat. It's not like you're not taking the first time that somebody figured out that we can print money like John Law did in hundreds of years before. You're taking 14 because that's when the modern fiat system came into place. Is that correct?
Yeah, these ones are like, you know, like the predecessors to Bitcoin, like e-gold and hash cash and these proto implementations. They were different in certain ways. So like the John Law's bubble was based on land in Mississippi, and this is different. We're not backing the monetary here by land in Mississippi. This is backed really by government credit. This is a system built on government credit, and this is like one implementation of it that has dominated the world in the 20th century. So how did it get so successful?
Is gold as a money a natural phenomenon? Is Bitcoin as a money a natural phenomenon as opposed to something that is applied by force?
I think so. I think if you look at all human societies at all times, I would contend they always naturally end up using the hardest liquid good to produce as money. So in prison, people use cigarettes. In islands, they use the rarest seashells. In West Africa, where they have no glass-making technology, they used glass beads. In industrial societies, they used gold, which was the hardest metal to make. Always, everywhere you go, money ends up being the hardest. And so, left to their own devices, this is what human beings would do. Governments mess with this, but even no matter how much they mess with it, it doesn't change the underlying reality. So even with government monies, the same thing is true. If you look at the supply growth rate for government monies, you see that the currencies that have the most value stored in them, the most valuable currencies in the world, are the ones that have the most, the lowest supply growth rates. You know, the best currencies in the world, the US dollar, the Swiss franc, the Japanese yen, the British pound, the euro, their supply grows every year at somewhere in the range of around 7-8% or so on average over the last few decades. You compare that to the smaller, less successful currencies, the ones that suffer from hyperinflation and high inflation and chronic inflation. These ones, their supplies grow at like 15, 20, 30, 50, sometimes 100, 200%. So the dollar and the stronger currencies continue to grow in terms of their market share. People all over the world want to hold more dollars and euros and francs and yens and these things at the expense of the weaker monies. Even with all of the government guns, they can't stop this. You know, in Venezuela, people hold dollars. In Lebanon and Zimbabwe, people want to hold dollars. And they hold probably now more dollars in cash in these countries than there is dollar than there is economic value in the local currency.
You said once that living in Lebanon, I think Bitcoin saved your life. Could you explain that? And is that the moment that you became a Bitcoiner?
No, I was a Bitcoiner earlier, but Bitcoin is, you know, there was a massive financial crisis in Lebanon. The banking system collapsed, the currency collapsed, everything collapsed. And so without Bitcoin, you know, I would have been financially ruined. And there was very few ways around it. It was devastating. You know, people's salaries went down by 80%, and people's savings went down by about 80% or 95% at this point. And this all happened very quickly. And people who didn't have Bitcoin suffered massively because of it. And this is why I find like a lot of the debates with economists to be just completely ridiculous. You know, you get all these economists that come up with all these extremely complicated reasons for why Bitcoin is not going to work and why Bitcoin is not how you should do money. And actually, here's how you should do Bitcoin in a better way. None of those people will tell me what I should have been doing in Lebanon otherwise. And none of these people will give me an actual working solution that could have saved me in Lebanon from hyperinflation. This is really
the thing. What year is this?
2019.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
That was after you wrote the book.
Yeah. Hyperinflation in Lebanon started in 2019.
Yeah, it's something that in the West we don't really. I mean, you see it once in a while, but you don't really know what's happening there.
Yeah, but basically, all over the world, everybody has suffered from this at some point, and it's something that you're going to be seeing more and more of, unfortunately, I think, over the coming few years.
So, going back to the timeline and the fiat inception, so to say, we started out with gold bugs. So
yeah, incidentally, I should add one small thing about Keynes since we are on the topic of Keynes, and that in 1914, he had written a memo to the Bank of England saying, congratulating them on what he called a masterly manipulation. That's what he called it, what they did with the bonds. So he knew about it because he worked at the Treasury at that time. He knew about it and he was very, very, very impressed. This is really the basic foundation of the monetary system. It's actually quite astounding. Here we are one century later and they're still pulling off the same stupid trick, which is we're not going to print money. No, we're going to buy bonds. That's different. We're not printing money. We're buying bonds.
And then you have the MMT crew saying basically if it works out on the Excel sheet, everything's okay. So that's the idea, right? Masterly manipulation.
Exactly. And their Excel sheet doesn't show you the world war and inflations and hyperinflations and big unsustainable bubble and the Great Depression and other world war that resulted from this one stupid little masterly manipulation. You know, as long as you continue to be delusional in the same way that Keynes was, which is completely reject any evidence that is against you and just only think of the world in the way that benefits you in a very sociopathic way. As long as you continue with that, then, you know, you're only seeing the benefits. The benefits are, oh, we got to make money and we got to fight the war and we got to do everything we want. And, you know, well, all right, bad things happen. because bad things happen, but we have nothing to do with it. None of our actions are in any way related to all of these bad things. So let's do it again. Let's do it with labor. Let's do it so that we can pay people more. Let's do it so that we can invest in all kinds of stupid things. Let's do it for eugenics. That was another Keynesian favorite idea. Let's do it for all kinds of insane stuff. And let's just continue to ignore the consequences. And it's been a century of people not thinking about the consequences. In fact, not just not thinking about the consequences, the way these morons work is that they are programmed to view the consequences as rationalization for more of the same. In other words, no matter how bad things get because of the stupid things that you do, the answer is for you to double down and do more stupid things.
Yeah, well, if you look at the discussion now, is that we have high inflation. What do we need to do? We need to hand out more money to the people, and then we need to cap the prices. And it's just, you know, doing more stupid things because it doesn't matter anymore anyway. But my argument for the gold standard or against the gold standard would be, and I say this as a gold bug, is that it's not a working solution if you can just suspend it that easily, right? So how would a Bitcoin world look like before we go even to the question how do we get there? But because one of the main arguments besides energy and other stuff is, oh my god, you can't have a deflationary money, you know, oh my god, the world would come to a standstill, nobody would work anymore. That's really what people believe. That is really ingrained in their thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks to suck. it sucks to believe stupid things. Really, if you think the idea of things getting cheaper is a bad thing, congratulations, you've been psyoped out of a working brain by your university. So here's a few questions to get to see if we can recover the wreck that is between your ears. Let's see. I don't mean you, obviously, Nico. I mean just people who mention this. So let's see. If you're watching this, you're watching it on some kind of technologically advanced piece of equipment, something like a laptop or an iPhone or an Android phone or a desktop computer. Now, look at this one particular instance of this thing that you're using right now. Let's assume you bought it. You bought it, let's say, this year. Think about how much money you paid for it. And think about how much money you would pay if you got this thing in 3 years. Same laptop. If you waited for 3 years, you know, think about how much the price would go down. Here's an idea. Look at the similar laptop to the one that you're using. So let's say you're using a MacBook Pro made in 2020. Look at one that was made in 2017 and see how much the price was. Or look at one that was made in 2019 and then see how much the price is today. See how much the laptop will decline in value in 3 years. And think about how much it could have declined in 3 years from the time you bought it, or 5 years or something like that. And then ask yourself, why did you not wait 5 years to buy this laptop? Why not just wait 5 years in order to get the laptop? And that might give you an idea about why you bought the laptop. And you bought the laptop because you valued the laptop at that time. 3 years ago or 2 years ago, you valued it more than the amount of money that you would have had in your bank account or in your Bitcoin wallet at that point. So the marginal value for you for adding one extra laptop to your life at that point was higher than having, let's say, $2,000 in your bank account. So you went ahead and bought the laptop, even though you knew that you could wait 3 years and get the same laptop for maybe $500 or $1,000 or whatever. Yet you didn't wait. Why? Because owning the laptop over those 3 years would have been worth the $1,000, right? Even though the price of the thing is going to go down, the value of using the laptop over those 3 years while you wait for the price to go down exceeds the cost saving. Okay? So there are people in 1980 that paid something like $3,500 for a hard drive that was had a capacity of 10 megabytes. 10 megabytes of data. Currently, you pay something in the cents for 10 megabytes of data. So you get a 1 terabyte hard drive right now is maybe, what, $20, $30, something like that. If you wanted to buy a 1 terabyte hard drive which is a megabyte, a gigabyte, a terabyte is a million megabytes. So 10 megabyte hard drive is 100,000 times smaller than the current one. So now for $30, for 1% of the cost of that one, which is $3,000, you get 100,000 times larger hard drive for 100% of the cost. So it's 10 million fold reduction in cost of a byte of data over the past 40 years. So why would you pay $3,000 for 10 megabytes of data when you could save, when you could pay 1 over 10 million if you just wait 40 years? And yet a lot of people bought hard drives in 1980. Some of those people, you would look back at them and not think that they're idiots for not waiting 4 years. Some of those people, somebody like Steve Jobs, he was one of the people probably buying a 10 megabyte hard drive for $3,500 at that time. That worked out well for him, right? Because he used that to start a company that did a lot of amazing products and made a lot of money for him and for shareholders. So is he going to not buy the hard drive because he's going to wait 40 years? No. So what we learn from here is that people don't make decisions about consumption in terms of just one general concern about whether this thing's price is going to go up or down in the future. The price of things will go up and down, but people care about the now, about the decision they make at the margin. And that's a concept that is completely absent from Keynes's work. He just doesn't understand the concept of margin. And so that's why they present this idea that, you know, people are just going to stop consuming. They present it in such a simplistic way that it's just the nullification of the entire idea of how economic reasoning works, which is we think in terms of the margin. So yes, people will reduce their consumption at the margin, but are people going to stop consuming? No, of course not. People consume when the marginal benefit of consumption is higher than the marginal cost of this consumption decision. So you will buy the laptop, you will buy the food, you will buy the house, you will buy the clothes that you need when you value those things more than having the money on you. The fact that those things are going to decline in value over time and the value of your money is going to go up at the margin will lead to you making fewer purchasing decisions. Right. That is correct. And that's a good thing. That means you're saving. That means you're not spending money that you don't need. In other words, it's not artificial and destructive that people reduce consumption when their money is hard. It's artificial and destructive when people consume things that they don't really need to consume or want to consume because their money is crappy. You're taking away from them the ability to save their money into the future and therefore forcing them to buy things that are inferior, that they don't want, that they don't value today, because you're presenting them with the alternative, which is that your money is going to be losing 10%. So if your money loses 10% per year, you decide, well, I don't really need to buy this table, or I don't really need to buy these clothes, but I'd rather buy them now than wait another year, because in a year I won't be able to afford them with the $100. The $100 is going to lose value. So you start buying needless junk that you don't need and you don't save. On the other hand, all of history, all of humanity, we're moving toward the hardest money. You know, the idea that I mentioned earlier, why Bitcoin and gold are natural, is that people just end up with their wealth stored in the hardest thing precisely because it holds value best. And then they choose to judiciously consume and invest in a way that maximizes their benefit from it. They only consume when they benefit significantly, and they only invest when they can benefit, because the alternative is that you win, is that you keep money in hard money, you keep value in hard money, it increases slightly over time. So everybody's winning at all times by default, just by turning up and storing value, you know, earning the money, storing it, you win. And then people invest and spend only when things truly improve them. So then in that world, people will not be consuming like idiots. People will consume like intelligent people. People will make intelligent consumption decisions. People will spend a lot less on stupid bullcrap. And of course, the amazing, hilarious irony of it is that the same kind of intellectually challenged person who tells you capitalism is unsustainable because people are consuming too much also believes that gold and Bitcoin are unsustainable because they don't encourage consumption enough, because we need an idiotic an idiotic treadmill. We need to put all of society on a treadmill, on like a hamster wheel, where everybody needs to be running and working to produce waste, basically. Everybody needs to be making production and then having some of that lost as waste, so that they're incentivized to spend their money on buying shit that they don't need. And then the insidious thing is that we then incentivize people to produce things that people don't really need. And so we end up with this high velocity trash economy, as Pierre Rochard calls it, where everybody has to spend. And so people are working on producing garbage for one another. And the result is high consumption and a high amount of indebtedness, because people borrow on credit, and low amounts of saving. And of course, environmental destruction. You know, these are the same people that are worried about carbon dioxide destroying the world. Carbon dioxide and cow farts are going to boil oceans somehow. That's a serious problem we should worry about. But the fact that we're consuming and depleting and destroying the soil and the earth because money, fiat money, is raising our time preference is something they don't seem to notice. I mean, it's just very basic common sense. If you're taking away from people the ability to store value into the future, the alternatives all degrade. You know, everything, you start degrading everything. You value the future less. There's less of an ability to save for the future. There's less of an ability to provide for the future. So therefore, you value the future less. You value money today more. So therefore, you strip mine your land and destroy the water aquifers because it gives you a big buck today. Therefore, you intensively farm your land with monocrop agriculture and destroy the soil and then just keep adding fertilizer until the soil is completely dead. But you do that rather than do sustainable methods of farming, because sustainable methods of farming don't pay you much today, but they pay off over the long term. So if we start discounting the long term because it's harder for us to save to the long term and because it's harder for us to see the long term, we start discounting it heavily. We start prioritizing everything that's truly degrading our natural environment around us. We're destroying the soil. We're destroying the environment. We're destroying real actual environmental assets that benefit us. We're destroying forests. We're chopping them down because our time preference is rising because of fiat. That's the real problem. So no, it's not a problem that we don't consume on Bitcoin. We are going to consume. We're going to consume enough. We're not going to consume stupid bullshit, and we're not going to consume the essential resources that we need for the long term.
I just have to take a second. So when I want to explain this without having like the time to go on an epic tirade like you just did, and I think you're absolutely right. I always tell people, instead of buying 20 pairs of shoes a year, we'll just buy one pair of shoes for 20 years. And people do get that because they understand, because we are all in this hamster wheel, and we're destroying the land, and we are consuming, and we don't know where to save, how to save our money, because there's no good options. Everything is bloated. Everything is broken. And then there's this feeling inside that something's wrong, but very few people, go do the work and go to the money, and then of course the incentives are there to turn the fiat clown world up and up and up and up, because what you just described, there still needs to be a huge gap, a huge collapse of everything that we call fiat capitalism in order to come to this more stable world.
No. The conclusion of the fiat standard is that maybe we don't. Maybe Bitcoin is just a technological upgrade that we need to get over fiat. We don't really need we don't really need to have to go through a lot of suffering. Maybe the last century of fiat was the catastrophe. Maybe two world wars and hundreds of millions of people killed by governments, and mass starvation all over the world, and destruction of trade and destruction of capital. Maybe that was the apocalypse it's, and maybe we're coming out the other end now. I think, you know, maybe I'm being delusional, but I think there is a case to be made for why Bitcoin doesn't have to be destructive, because so when you think about hyperinflation, you know, you think about a situation like Lebanon or Venezuela, the reason it is bad is not just that people lose their life savings. That's terrible, obviously, and it's terrible for the people, and it's terrible for society in general. But this is really just one small part of it. The bigger picture is the fact that the division of labor, the economic structure of production in society, the entire sophisticated web of producers and consumers that has been built up over decades and centuries comes to a stop when you don't have a form of money that can be used within that society. So you need, in order for us to have a modern society, in order for us to have a city, you know, in order for cities to exist, we need a strong division of labor. Cities mean the majority of the population in the city is not working and producing food. Somebody out there needs to be working on producing food. That already requires very high amount of specialization, because somebody, a lot of other people are going to be working on producing the food, and the people in the city are going to be doing all kinds of other things. If you get to that level, you need to have a form of money. There's no way around it. You need to have a form of money to facilitate this division of labor, because without it, you cannot calculate and you cannot have economic production. You cannot have long relationships of supply chains that last over time. You can't build that structure without money. So when you destroy the value of currency, it's not just that you take away people's savings and destroy their livelihoods. It's even worse than that. The worst thing is that you bring about the destruction of this structure of production. So a lot of businesses can't operate, even though those businesses are successful. You know, this is maybe the saddest part, is that, all right, some people lost their money because they put their money in a bank. Well, you know, you probably should have known better than to trust a government bank with your savings. But even the people who didn't get financially ruined, because my business relies on using a bank and a currency in order for me to get all of the stuff from my importers and to send all my stuff to the people that buy my exports. And in order for me to deal with all of my suppliers and consumers and producers and workers and everybody in the country and outside the country, I need a currency. When the currency stops working, when the banks close down, when the banks have capital controls, all of that stuff comes crashing down. And then the economic production in the society grinds to a halt. It's not just that we've destroyed a lot of wealth that exists in financial assets. We also destroy the production process. And that's because there is no currency. Because in your country, when it has a hyperinflation, you can't just build a bank on an alternative monetary system. You can't just go and say, all right, we're going to just, you know, you can't go to Lebanon today and just set up a dollar-based bank and say, all right, we're not going to deal with this banking system or the central bank. We're going to do a new bank, and it's based on dollars. And you deposit dollars, and we deal with international banks. You can't do that. You have to have a license from the central bank, and the central bank is not going to do it. That's their entire hustle. They're not going to let you just go around them. So you only really get the destruction from hyperinflation after you get the destruction of the currency, when there is no alternative, when governments have a monopoly on the central bank. But with Bitcoin, we do have an alternative. We have a monetary system that people can upgrade to. So as the problems intensify, as Bitcoin grows, Bitcoin just gets used more and more by people. And then people are able to switch to a new monetary system and continue to operate even as their national currencies fall apart. So this is one reason I think Bitcoin can prevent hyperinflation from being catastrophic, because it offers a safety net. And then the other thing is that I don't think the rise of Bitcoin leads to a destruction of the value of fiat, because yes, people use Bitcoin more means they hold more Bitcoin and hold fewer fiat, but it also means that they create less fiat. This is the point behind, you know, thinking about fiat as credit in the book. Is a really powerful tool, because you then realize, well, why is there so much credit being issued all over the US? Because issuing credit is like printing new money. So if you have a new technology for printing money that doesn't require you to issue credit, well, that's going to reduce demand for credit creation. You know, a lot less people are going to want to save their money in bonds and financial instruments that are based around debt, that create debt and add debt to the money supply. That then means you're going to not just get a reduction in demand for dollars, you're going to get a reduction in supply for dollars. So if fewer bonds are printed because fewer people are buying bonds, government bonds and corporate bonds, if fewer loans are taken out because people are no longer getting into debt to buy houses, people are paying off their debt because they're stacking Bitcoin and they're paying off their debt from Bitcoin. If people get out of the debt system and they upgrade to Bitcoin, and if people put their savings in Bitcoin instead of debt, that's going to reduce the ability of the fiat system to create money. Now, of course, governments can counteract that by printing money directly and handing it out to people. So we'll see. But the point is that I think inflation is going to be a self-inflicted thing, like if you see it in Venezuela or Lebanon. You know, it's not like Bitcoin brought this about. When you get a government that literally starts printing physical notes and handing them out like candy, you're going to get hyperinflation.
Is that your base case? Because I mean, your argument before the deflationary world, the deflationary money is very easy to make because when you see the world going into the dollar right now. It's not deflationary, but it's the best and hardest, you know, the cleanest shirt, right? Do you expect to hyperinflation in more countries?
I think so. I think the last couple of years are going to make things much worse for the vast majority of countries in the world. I mean, you suspend economic production and tell people to stop working for a few months because of a virus. This isn't a freaking game where you can just hit pause. It's not. I think a big part of it is video games ruined a generation of people who think life can just be paused. You know, wait, hang on a second. I'm going to pause this game while I go to the bathroom or while I go grab a bite. And then I'm going to come back and pick up. You know, the villain is going to stay paused. Life is not like that. Economics is not like that. Economics is a daily struggle for existence and survival. And I mean, the people who stopped for a couple of years, the idea that they could just move on with their lives and resume it normally is insane. And I think the damage is already being felt in the poorest countries in the world. In the richer countries, it's been delayed slightly in that they handed out money and everybody thought scarcity doesn't exist anymore. And we can just print money. Well, now the bill is coming in terms of inflation. I think we're just going to see more and more inflation, in particular in developing countries and poorer countries. Turkey is already having very bad inflation. I think we're just going to see more and more cases like that. All governments went crazy over the last couple of years, and you know they were already massively irresponsibly indebted, and now they're just becoming more and more massively irresponsibly indebted. And you can't cheat math forever. Eventually, math is going to come back.
But isn't that what you're supposed to do anyway? I mean, if you want to derail a train, you either hit the brakes or you hit the gas, right? So I mean, the whole COVID, the lockdowns, the printing money, it just accelerated the fiat endgame. If you want,
I think so. I think it was a big massive shot of steroids, really, to the process. And in a way, it's I was writing the book to kind of explain the relative stability and success of fiat, in that, you know, say what you want, but it's been 50 years, and I was writing this book in 2020 to publish it in 2021.
This laptop years. Was produced and bought by fiat, so many good things have happened in the last 50 years.
Yeah, and it's been around for 50 years. And like, you know, realistically, it should have blown up in the first year. It should have blown up in the first week, month, year, 2 years. And yet it keeps tugging along. It keeps moving along. Now, that doesn't mean that it is good. And that doesn't, you know, just because you managed to survive through something doesn't mean that you should you should use more of it. Like, you know, if you get into a car accident and you survive, doesn't mean you should doesn't mean if you get into car accidents every day then you'll be immortal. It's still a bad thing to get into the car accident. And this is a bad thing. I think it's it's destructive in many ways, and I outline all the ways in which cost, and you know, I try and do cost benefit analysis on it. People are always telling us about the cost of Bitcoin. Well, here's an example of the real cost of fiat. You know, let's think about what is the cost of fiat in terms of the inflation that it causes and the wealth transfer and the amount of power that it gives to governments. It's a lot of stuff going on. It's a lot of bad things that it does. It survives because it has the ability to, government has the ability to stop gold. This is ultimately why I think the fiat system works. The fiat system works because governments can stop gold clearance. You can't move gold around. You know, in order to move gold around, you need facilities, you need central banks, you need transparency, you need publicly open and auditable facilities. And that just means governments are going to take over things and they're going to be in charge of it. So you just can't have a free market in gold. You can't have free market and free clearance of money with gold. So if you can't have it with gold, the alternative is that you have to have it with government credit. That's the only thing that can travel. That's the only thing that government lets you have. That's ultimately what it comes down to. So in a sense, it wins the race because it's dad. It's like the kid who wins the race because the dad goes and shoots all the other kids running in the race. And then the slow kid wins. But now we've invented a kid that can't be shot.
That is a perfect segue to my last question, or like maybe two questions, because I do want to ask you one thing. You are a hugely controversial figure. You have strong opinions on almost everything, and you spend a lot of time on Twitter. Would Bitcoin be here without, you know, people like you and other, you know, people who explain it? I mean, is this something that needs the people like us, or is it something that would just be successful anyway? And also the whole getting other opinions into it and the whole infighting about ideologies, is that something that you see as destructive or something that necessary, or what do you think about that?
I think all of that is just nonsensical drama that people essentially, primarily people who are not productive are the ones who get bogged down in this nonsense about tone policing and how can you believe this and how can you say that. It's never the people that are actually producing things that are valuable that are engaging in this kind of nonsense. I think the answer is I don't think Bitcoin needs me or needs anybody. There's nobody who's irreplaceable for Bitcoin. People need Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't need anyone. Bitcoin doesn't need anyone in particular, but Bitcoin is just so good and so powerful that it necessarily and almost inevitably ends up tempting people to join it and work for it because it rewards them.
And talk about it all day long. I mean, it is a thing. It is a thing. When once you discover Bitcoin, you know, people hate you for talking about Bitcoin all day long for a while.
Until they get bitten by the bug themselves and they can't stop talking about it. But I mean, like it doesn't matter. I think we need Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't need us. And I think, you know, it's perfectly normal that people make careers in Bitcoin, that people talk about Bitcoin, because, you know, there's a lot of demand out there for people to understand what's going on. It's good for me if I do this because, you know, I'm able to work a much better job than if I was just teaching a few students at a fiat university. And it's good for people who benefit from this stuff, who read the books and understand what's going on. But I think the nature of this technology is that it succeeds because it rewards people who use it. As Ralph Merkel says in that quote that I mentioned in the Bitcoin Standard, it's almost like a new form of life because it feeds off people. You know, we feed it and it gives us an incentive to feed it. It survives because it can trust in us wanting to feed it. And so I think it's just going to continue, and it doesn't need any of us. And I think generally this whole idea of how could you say this and how could you say that, like, It's just it's leftover fiat brains that people need to get over. It's not Bitcoin life that is exceptional in this regard. It's fiat world that is exceptional in this dogmatic capture of terminology. It's not so exceptional. All religions are like this, in a sense, to an extent at least. You know, there are things that are sacrilegious that you cannot say. And it's just, it's very tiresome in the modern religion because, you know, it's a stupid religion. It's new and it's the new stuff is never as good as the old stuff. I know it's, if your religion hasn't been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, then it's probably got, it doesn't have a lot of staying power. So this religion, current fiat religion, is all about, I argue in the fiat standard, the contention that I try and make is that the reason these insane ideas of people need to stop consuming hydrocarbon fuels and people need to stop consuming meat, the reason there's a lot of idiotic pseudoscience that reaches this idiotic conclusion is obviously not because it is true. If you spend 15 minutes looking into it, you quickly realize this is nonsense. It's because of inflation. It's because this is fiat science. It's financed by fiat governments. And fiat governments want you, it's very important for them to you believe that there's no inflation problem. So how can they get inflation down? An excellent way to get inflation down is to get you to consume less. You know, if everybody lives like a 13th century peasant, there is no hyperinflation. If everybody eats industrial waste processed into ready meals that gets delivered to their tiny little bug pod where you can't leave because of, you know, climate lockdowns, and you just get your little soy and bug and seed oil package in one small little package that you just eat once a day, you get optimal nutrition according to government guidelines. You don't leave your house. You don't need any fuel. You live in a tiny little pod, which is very cheap to keep warm. There's no inflation. I mean, you're living like a 13th century, well, worse, because you don't get enough sunshine and you don't get enough food. But if you don't consume energy, if you don't consume modern energy sources, and if you don't consume high nutrient food, healthy and high nutrient food, inflation is not a problem. So you'll see a lot of sciences that talk about this. And this is why what I find ridiculous is, you know, I talk about this because I think it's extremely relevant to inflation. And the whole book studies this phenomenon centrally. Like, let's look at the science behind the idea that hydrocarbons are boiling the oceans. Where did this stupid idea come from? Why do those people believe it? What is the evidence for it? What is the evidence against it? And I challenge people who, a lot of people get emotional about this. Of course, none of them are willing to have a serious argument about it. But really, why is this a crisis? Where is the crisis? Show me where is the crisis. What is the evidence for there being a crisis? They can't present it. But yet they feel so strongly about the fact that, oh no, you can't say this. And then they, you know, they start with the tone policing of the idea that, oh no, you speak for Bitcoin and you're a figure for Bitcoin and you're going to turn people away from Bitcoin. And that, you know, you need to be an idiot in order for Bitcoin to work, because we need to get idiots to use Bitcoin. And the answer is no, Bitcoin doesn't work if idiots need to use it on their terms.
I see it from the other side. Like, I see that, you know, look at this guy talking this, saying this and that, and you're not allowed to say this, and he's crazy. And he's talking for Bitcoin, so Bitcoin must be bad, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but the point is, if you think this way, well, you're not going to make it anyway. Like, this is not the right mentality to get into Bitcoin. If you think I speak for Bitcoin, if you think I define what Bitcoin is, if you think that I'm the face of Bitcoin, you don't understand what Bitcoin is and you're not ready for Bitcoin. And if you get into Bitcoin, you're likely going to get into some stupid shitcoin scam, and you're likely going to get wiped out. Like, this is a level of fiat immaturity that is not compatible with holding your own private keys and running your node and living your life on the Bitcoin standard.
I do agree that now that I have started, you know, talking to even more and more Bitcoiners, that in order to be able to hold a conversation, you need to grow up. You know, you need to be able to accept that somebody else has strong opinions about something that might differ from yours, and it's okay. you know, because we are incentivized or to believe that it's not okay. You know, your opinion is not okay. My opinion is okay because they say so. But you said that Bitcoin is the kid that cannot be shot, and then you described all the ideas of fighting inflation. You know, smaller houses, lower standard of living. So the incentives are set in a way that you know the fiat system goes on and on and on, and that the guardians of the fiat system seem to stop at nothing to manage that. So there will be enormous attacks on Bitcoin, right? I mean, we haven't seen anything yet.
Perhaps, yeah. But I mean, there will. I don't see how self-censorship helps in any way. And I think Bitcoin is such a transformational technology in the way that it affects society, in the way that it changes how people think of money. There's no escaping the fact that this has consequences. So if you come from fiat world and you want to believe the pretty lies of fiat, you can't choose to, you can't choose to swim and not get wet. You can't choose to get into Bitcoin, enjoy number go up technology, watch Bitcoin continue to grow, redefine what money is, change money from what the government says it is to what the market says it is in front of your own eyes, and yet continue to believe the lies that government can only force you to believe because of their money printer, because it is their money printer that finances all those actors who get on TV and say they are scientists and they have decided that the science says you need to live like a 13th century peasant. That's where all of that stuff comes from. And, the only acceptable and respectable positions for you to take are A, respond and try and argue with the substance of the argument. You know, you're saying that cow farts don't boil oceans. Well, here's why actually I think that cow farts boil oceans. This would be a respectable thing to say. You can ignore it. You can decide who cares about what Saif thinks about climate. You know, Saif is also a Liverpool fan, and he occasionally posts Mo Salah goals and Sadio Mane brilliance. And you might be a Manchester United fan, and you're not going to get angry and tell me you can't post Liverpool. Somehow nobody tells me don't post Liverpool. That's alienating other teams' fans. People are much more mature about things like football than they are about religions like climate change or whatever. So you can ignore it. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what I think about this issue. It doesn't matter what you think, perhaps. Maybe you don't care about it. Maybe I don't care about it. So that's a perfectly respectable position that you just, you know, maybe you're interested in my work in Bitcoin. You do not care about what I think about diet and the climate and football. And so you ignore it. That's also perfectly acceptable. What's completely not respectable and acceptable and makes me completely lose any respect for you as an individual and makes me realize that I have no interest in getting into conversation with you is trying to tell me that I cannot talk about this, that I shouldn't say this. You know, you're not getting into the argument. You're not telling me you're wrong. You're not telling me this is right, this is wrong, here's where you're wrong, here's where you're right. No, you're arguing with me about whether I can say this or not. And that's just a complete non-argument. There is no argument there. You're not my mom. I don't have to justify things for you. I'm not in a position where I owe you anything. You're not paying me. You're not in a position where you are my boss and I need to talk to report to you. So you are free to ignore everything I say. You can mute me, block me on Twitter. You don't have to subject to stuff. My stuff is not mandatory. And it's not imposed on you, so you have no right to argue with it. You have no reason to argue with it because you can just ignore it. And it's also, you're not paying for it. So it's not a business that you're paying for. Me on Twitter is not this is the problem. A lot of people have, you know, the culture of customer service has created a very entitled generation of people who think everything they see on the internet has got a waiter behind it, and you can just call the waiter and tell him, hey, I don't like this. You know, my soup is too cold. Your jokes on climate change are not funny enough. Don't make that. Don't say that. That's not how the internet works. You need to grow up, understand how the world works, understand that people have opinions that you might disagree with. I welcome disagreement and substantive argument. I do not welcome tone policing. I do not welcome speech policing. And this is what it comes down to. This is really what it comes down to. Like, it's enormous, the number of people that have strong opinions about what I can and cannot say, and what I should and should not say, and whether it's effective or not, whether it's good for me, whether it's good for Bitcoin. But they don't have something to add that's substantive about this. Like, tell me, why am I wrong? Where is the wrong conclusion here? What am I wrong about? Explain it. For every 100 people that want to tone police you and mock you and tell you you can't say this and tell you you don't have the right credentials, for every 100 person, I think you would not get one person who would engage with the substance of the argument.
In the end, it all boils down to the very simple rule when it comes to Twitter or other interactions is, you know, try not to interact with the one hater, try to interact with the people who actually like your work and want to add to it, or maybe criticize it in a good way, but not then with tone policing. Even though I am pretty sure that after a certain age, your mom also didn't have a chance and wasn't able to stop you talking about your opinions. Saif,
yeah,
please send us off with your, where can we find you besides Twitter? What's your next plans? What's the next book going to be called? Are you still, you know, do you still have a standard to write about?
My next book is Principles of Economics, which I'm finishing up now. I've written 13 out of 17 chapters, about 4 chapters left, and I'm hoping to get it out by the end of this year. And I'm also teaching a course on my website, saifeddin.com. So my website, saifeddin.com, is where you can find all my work, my books, and my courses. And Study Today, we just released a new course, which begins today. Well, by the time this is out, it's going to have begun in a couple of weeks, but you can still sign up weekly lectures on a course on the fiat standard. So weekly video lectures, mm-hmm. and one weekly interactive seminar. And I'm on Twitter at Saifeddin. And where else? And the Bitcoin Standard podcast. Yes, check out my podcast, the Bitcoin Standard podcast as well. Yeah, and my books, the Bitcoin Standard and the Fiat Standard.
Yes, so the Fiat Standard is going to be published at the end of May in German at Apricot Media. Saif, thank you so much. Have a good day. Danke fürs Zuhören bei dieser Folge von Was Bitcoin bringt. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, bitte hinterlasst uns 5 Sterne bei Apple und bei Spotify, folgt uns auf YouTube, schickt uns eure Eindrücke, eure Ideen, eure Anregungen, eure Vorschläge für Gäste und natürlich auch eure Kritik an hallo@wasbitcoinbringt.com. Was nicht unerwähnt bleiben darf, natürlich auch Value for Value. Dieser Podcast läuft über das Lightning-Netzwerk in allen Kanälen. Man kann streamen, man kann spenden. Es gibt einen Spenden-Button auch auf wasbitcoinbringt.com inzwischen. Und diese Dinge sind auch wahnsinnig motivierend, wenn da ein bisschen was reinkommt, wenn jeder das nutzt. Es macht wirklich viel Freude, als Bitcoiner für Bitcoiner zu arbeiten.
Die Veröffentlichungen in diesem Podcast sowie die darin enthaltenen Hinweise, die im Begleitmaterial gesetzten Links, dienen ausschließlich Informationszwecken und stellen weder eine Anlageberatung, Anlageanalyse noch eine Aufforderung oder Empfehlung zum Erwerb oder Verkauf von Finanzinstrumenten dar. Insbesondere kann eine Anlage oder sonstige Beratung dadurch nicht ersetzt werden. Die in den Veröffentlichungen erhaltenen Angaben basieren auf dem Wissensstand zum Zeitpunkt der Ausarbeitung und können jederzeit ohne weitere Benachrichtigungen geändert werden. Die Inhalte richten sich ausschließlich an natürliche Personen. Es wird keine Haftung für die Richtigkeit, Vollständigkeit oder Aktualität der zur Verfügung gestellten Informationen, Informationsquellen, daraus resultierenden Haftungen oder Schäden jedweder Art übernommen. Eine Haftung für leicht fahrlässiges Verhalten wird jedenfalls ausgeschlossen.